All right, as a race, we tend to put great emphasis and great power on when things come to an end. But before we get to that, because I think that this is simply the extenuating results of what happened to begin with, but when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, what happened to them in the wilderness?
They murmured and complained.
They murmured and complained, and how many of them came into the promised
land?
Two. Two. So did God put an end to Israel even in the wilderness? In a sense, right? I mean, he put an end to that generation, and he gave the next generation an opportunity. And then throughout the period of the judges, what would happen? The people would become unfaithful. What would God do?
Send a judge.
He'd send a judge. What would the... Well, before he sent the judge, what would he send?
Oppressor.
All right, he sent an oppressor. So throughout the entire period of the judges, I think it was like 200 or 300 years, God kept on doing the same thing, punishing the people, letting them repent, punishing the people. And then throughout the time of the kings, we have the same situation. And so this, in a sense, is simply what God has been doing from the very beginning of Israel being called out of Egypt, with, of course, one exception, and that is this time nobody's coming back. This time he brings it to a complete end. And so, as I say, this is a class that we might consider to be it's just very final. But whenever somebody dies, how final is it?
Final.
So this is happening all the time. And so the events here are important, but they are simply God continuing to do what he does, which is when people won't obey him, he punishes them, either by person, by generation, or in this case, when he's working directly with these people, by direct intervention. So God has sent two prophets. We talked about them over the last couple of weeks. Remember their names? The two prophets that were sent to Israel?
Hosea.
Okay, Hosea was one. And
Amos
was the other one. All right. And we saw in both of those prophets that God was telling them. And let's go ahead and look at these verses. Matter of fact, I think we'll start in the middle today. We never seem to get one way or the other. So let's start with Ray. Ray, would you read Amos chapter 3:11?
3:11. Thus says the Lord, as a shepherd takes from the mouth of a lion two legs or a piece of an ear, so shall the children of Israel be taken out who dwell in Samaria.
Okay, so what has God told the people through? Now, this is a prophecy, right? When God makes a prophecy, what always happens? It always gets fulfilled. And so he says, as a shepherd takes from the mouth of a lion two legs or a piece of an ear. Now, is one a little more than the other? There's a little more left with two legs than there is with a piece of an ear? Well, two legs is a lot more than a piece of an ear. If God said to America, I'm going to destroy you, would you rather have two legs left or a piece of an ear? Which one would you pick? See, I'd pick the two legs. But obviously, who's going to determine whether it's two legs or a piece of an ear?
God.
Well, God, based on what?
On
what the people do.
Yeah.
If the people listen to Amos, Amos is offering them a promise here. It's a prophecy, but it's a prophecy with a promise. So as the shepherd takes from the mouth of a lion two legs or a piece of an ear, so shall the children of Israel be taken out who dwell in Samaria. Now, you remember when God said, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but when God had Judah go into captivity, do you remember how many people there were that went into captivity? It was like 800 in the first wave and like 1,500 in the next wave and then about 2,000 or 3,000 in the next wave. The total number of people is 4,000 out of the whole nation of Judah. So when you think about these people going to captivity, you don't think about 100,000 or 200,000 or 500,000 people. A piece of an ear would be about that. Maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people is all that's going to be left. So and then he also says through Hosea, Laura, you want to read that next scripture? I know it's kind of broken up, but Amos chapter 4, 6 through 12.
I gave you cleanliness
of teeth and lack of bread, yet you have not returned to me. I withheld rain from you, yet you have not returned to me. I blasted you with blight and mildew, locust devoured, yet you have not returned to me. I sent among you plague, young men killed with a sword, yet you have not returned to me. I overthrew some of Sodom and Gomorrah, yet you have not returned to me. Therefore, prepare to meet your God, O Israel.
Could he be any clearer? And could they relate to that? I mean, wouldn't they remember the time when there was a famine and they couldn't, wasn't any reason to brush your teeth because you hadn't eaten anything? That's what cleanness of teeth infers. So, or they didn't have enough rain. Remember when Ahab was going from place to place looking for pasturage for his animals because everything was dying. I blasted you with blight and mildew. And so they could go back and they could relate these things, and they hadn't repented. So when it says prepare to meet your God, if you got a letter tomorrow that said that, what would you do? You make some serious changes in your life. If God said, okay, I've done this, 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 and this to America, and now I want you to know, prepare to meet your God, America. Now, maybe the rest of Americans aren't going to do anything, but wouldn't you like to be one of those pieces of ears or two legs? And that's what it's going to be determined by. So God has given Israel its final warning in Amos. And then Hosea, he begins his work about the same time. And what he says is Hosea 13:16. Jeannie, you want to read that? Not the first one, not 1:1, but 13:16.
Samaria is held guilty, for she has rebelled against her God. They shall fall by the sword. Their infants shall be dashed in pieces, and their women with child ripped open.
Okay, now is this something God wants to happen? No. But when you use an axe, what happens? The axe will do what an axe does. He uses Assyria. How does Assyria take care of their captives? Well, they do this. They dash the children. They kill the children. Let's don't even go into the details of it, but this is how Hosea ends his book. This is what's coming. Now, did it even create a ripple? See, they didn't do anything. When Amos was there, that priest from Bethel said, go home. We don't want to hear what you have to say. And so this is the end. There's nothing more to be done. God has done everything he could do. And now the only thing left is for them to be destroyed. And then see, we have the chronology here in that little box in the middle of the page. We kind of left off with Jeroboam and his four generations. So Jeroboam is when Amos and Hosea began their work. I'm going to hold off on Isaiah until we get to the book of, or until we get to the Judah and talk a little bit about their kings. So Amos begins his work exclusively in the reign of Jeroboam, but Hosea's work continues through Hezekiah. So you see where Hezekiah is in the right hand column. So since Hosea, and I wrote that in the verse there, Hosea 1:1, right up above the box there, it says Hosea, the word of the Lord came to Hosea in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now there's a big difference between Amos and Hosea. Amos comes from Judah to Israel and then goes home. Where does Hosea live? He lives in Israel. So he stays. Hosea stays throughout the reign of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. So he's there right up until the destruction of Israel. So that's what's happening here. We have these kings, as I said, Jeroboam, Zechariah, Shalom. These are people who are his offspring, and then of course things really start to turn after that. So as I point out in that box underneath, or the first paragraph underneath the box, there isn't much to be said about the kings who lived after Jeroboam. God doesn't record anything about them. He simply records who they were, how long they reigned, and that they were evil. And then it's also recorded how Assyria became more and more aggressive in their attempts to conquer them. And so we start with Menahem, which is 1 to 10 years after the death of Jeroboam. So 1 to 10 years after that death, pull king of Assyria. Well, let's see. I'll have somebody else read here. Darlene, you want to read that verse for us, please? 2 Kings 15, 19.
Pul, king of Assyria, came against the land, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver that his hand might be with him to strengthen the kingdom under his control. And Menahem exacted the money from Israel, from all the very wealthy, from each man 50 shekels of silver to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and did not stay there in the land.
Okay, so when it says in the very beginning, he came against the land, what does that generally mean? If Assyria came up against the land, what was his initial intent? To take it. What does the king do?
Bribe him.
He bribes him. And because the bribe was big enough, the king leaves. But it isn't very long later, in the reign of Pekah, which is about maybe 8 years later, then things really start to turn bad. Jack, you want to read that for us, please?
In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Ijon, Abel-Beth, Makkah, Janoah, Kadesh, Hazor, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria.
Okay. So, sorry about all those names, Jack. But I couldn't think of a better guy to give them to, actually. Okay, so Tiglath-Pileser is one of the kings of Assyria, and he comes and he takes these cities. Now, it sounds like he's taking all the people captive and taking them back, but is that really how these people work? They come to a town, the town has got walls and a gate, so they block, they try to defend themselves, and so they break the defense, and then they just capture everybody? Is that how it works? No, generally speaking, there's a battle. Men try to protect their women and their children, and so there's a battle, and when all's said and done, there's just a few people out of each of these cities that are going to be taken prisoner. The rest of them are going to be put to death. So this is a good portion of Israel has now been taken. And then during the reign of Hoshea, which is 30 to 39 years after the death of Jeroboam, you might be wondering why I keep going back to Jeroboam, but it's because that's when Amos and Hosea began their preaching. So this is when they were getting their last warnings. So within 10 years of their last warning, Assyria comes into the land. Now, is 10 years very long? So if 10 years ago, somebody had gotten up and said to America, within 10 years from now, things are going to start really turning bad, and then in the ninth or the 10th year, here comes Russia knocking at our door, if we had any spirituality about us at all, what would we be thinking? Now, I remember that prophet. That prophet said this was going to happen. And of course, within 10 years, 8 to 10 years, they should change. Well, they dodged it. They were able to escape it. But then another 12 to 30 years later, here comes Tiglath-Pileser, and he takes a good section of the nation, destroys, and then takes them into captivity. And then during the reign of Hoshea, which is 30 to 40 years after, that's when the destruction occurs. So let's see, where are we going from here? Let's go forward. Virgil, you want to take that one, please? Very bottom of page 1 and then on to page 2.
You talk about the names you gave Jack.
Yeah, Shalmaneser and Hoshea. We can handle that, right?
Yeah. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him. Hosea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. And the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hosea, for he had sent messengers to Saul, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up, bound him in prison.
Okay, so what's Hosea trying to do? He's been put under the king of Assyria. He's been paying him tribute money. Now he sends a message to the Pharaoh, and he doesn't pay tribute any money anymore. What does that probably mean that he and Pharaoh have decided to do?
Form an alliance.
Okay, they formed an alliance, and this man is completely relying on Egypt to save him. Well, what happened? See, it didn't happen. The king of Assyria put him in prison. Then is when the destruction occurs. So, Martha, you want to read that for us? 2 Kings 17, 5 and 6.
Now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala and by Habar, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of Medes.
Okay. Now, we don't get a lot of detail here, but you remember when Nebuchadnezzar besieged Judah, Jerusalem, and what were women doing to their children? They were eating their children. And you remember when there was Samaria was besieged during the time of Elijah, and they were eating a small portion of dung, of the dove, was it? Dove dung? You remember they were buying dove dung, and they were a donkey's head. And in other words, if you have a three-year siege, what's happening in the city? Yeah, you're running out of food. And so, and God promised them this. I say promise. God threatened them. God told them, if you stop serving me, then I'm going to do things that are going to cause you more grief than you can imagine. And he says, the most dainty woman among you is going to kill her children and eat them and hide them from other people because they don't want them to have any of it. And, I mean, can you imagine? And even in our country, do you think that would happen? You think if people were hungry, they'd kill and eat their kids?
Yes.
Well, it probably has, but I think the normal, would this be a widespread problem, I guess is what I'm asking you. Would most people starve or would they kill their children?
Starve.
See, I know what I'd do. I would starve before I would even think of something like that. And I think, at least I would like to think, that most people in America still have that mindset, although we talked about that a couple days ago. Not everybody thinks the way I think and you think, but you'd like to think they do. But obviously, there's some situation. But anyway, you can read a lot between the lines here. When he went throughout all the land, that meant he was killing and pillaging, raping, destroying, cutting up and cutting open these women with child. And then he comes to Samaria and he besieges it for 3 years. Nobody comes in, nobody goes out. They're trying to break through. Of course, they break through and everybody just puts their hands up, right? No, there's going to be a battle, and once again, there's going to be some terrible things. As he said, they shall fall by the sword. Their infants shall be dashed in pieces. Their women with child shall be ripped open. Now, if that didn't happen, then what would that mean about Hosea's prophecy? It wouldn't be true. So these are the things, and again, you don't want to make things worse than they are, but you sure don't want to sugarcoat it either. When you rebel against God, and you are preparing to meet God, is it going to be better or worse than you think? See, do you think hell's going to be better than we think it is?
No.
Or you think it might be a little worse than we think it is? I think it's going to be a lot worse than anybody can imagine. And so the events that are going on here, and again, why is God doing this? Why doesn't God just let people live their lives and then when they die, he either sends them to heaven or hell? Why does he keep intervening here? Why does he keep punishing people? What's he trying to accomplish? Excuse me?
Repentance.
Okay, there's two things, really. Number one, as Isaiah pointed out, if we didn't have a promise of having to bring the seed into the world, we would have become like Sodom and Gomorrah. So God would have punished them because, as we learned from Jesus, when the fig tree doesn't produce figs anymore, what do? We cut it down and throw it into the fire. When a country, a nation, no longer produces anything for God, there's no longer any people coming out of that nation for God, what does he do? He does the same thing. And so the reason it happened to Israel, again, two purposes. And I think the most important one is for us today. When God makes prophecies about how bad it's going to be, do they come true?
Yes.
mean, Moses was telling the people in Deuteronomy, if you don't serve God, here's what's going to happen. Did it happen? Yeah, it all happened. So Jesus says, if you don't cut it off and cast it from you, your whole body is going to be cast into hell. Think it's going to be? It won't be that bad. It's not going to be that bad, right? No, it's going to be worse. Charles?
Yeah, also along the same line, you know, the Bible teaches us that, you know, we have these things for an example. Whatever things was written for time was written for our learning. So we have an opportunity to read and see what happened to those individuals when they were disobedient to God.
Right.
So as we live today, we're still facing the same thing. It's not any different from us today, but a lot of people don't want to look at it that way. But we still are going to go through the same thing if we don't
right.
do what God has told us to do.
We also bear a greater responsibility.
Well, that's true. That's true. God's people do have a greater responsibility.
Yeah.
Because we've already got this history written. And as I've said many times in the last few years, as we see our country just descending into ungodliness, I mean, at a certain point, you know what's going to happen, right? And that which has been is that which shall be, and that which has been done is that which shall be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. So we like to think, well, America is going to be able to avoid this, and we won't have these things happen. But is that true? It's not true. And so the more evil we see coming into the country, what do we know? What's knocking at the door? Some kind of judgment. And as I say, you can be praying maybe for a less severe judgment. I mean, I don't want to see the country fall. But then you say, well, what would you rather have then if it's not going to fall? Would you rather have a new depression? Anybody here want a depression? How about a good plague go through and wipe out half the country? Wouldn't that be better? Well, what are you going to pick? You know, something has to happen. Some kind of cataclysmic thing has to happen that brings people to their senses. And I don't know what it's going to be. It may not be anything. We may just fall. We may just be destroyed. But one thing's for sure, if we keep going in the direction we're going and we don't turn, what's going to happen sooner or later?
Yeah.
This is what's going to happen. It's what always happens. And God is no respecter of persons. So these are the kind of things we need to be understanding and realizing. And then you start saying, you know, I need to be more circumspect, right? I need to be more careful. Because if this fall comes, remember what Jesus said about one will be taken and one will be left? You want to be the taken one or the left one? See, so that's something to think about. Okay, any other thoughts on that? All right. Now, the latter part of the 17th chapter is God's indictment against Israel. In other words, these are the charges, and I suspect we'll hear them again on the judgment day. Because when we stand before God in judgment, are charges going to be brought forth?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And after they're brought forth, are we going to have a chance to defend ourselves? See, the judgment day is kind of a fascinating thing. Remember what Jesus said? The men of Sodom and Gomorrah are going to rise up and condemn this generation because if the things that happened in Sodom and Gomorrah that had happened here, they would have repented. And you're thinking, how's that going to work? You ever thought about that? How's it going to work on the judgment day where one generation, the Queen of Sheba, is going to rise up against this generation and condemn it? So the judgment day is going to be a very interesting situation. Every idle word that you've spoken, what are you going to do on the judgment day? You're going to give an account. And the books are going to be opened. And we're going to hear about our lives. And so it's not going to be just a situation where it's just quick and it's finished. This could go on a while. And so this kind of gives you an idea of what could be happening there. Now, we're getting a little shy of time, so I won't have you read all of these things. But it just basically lays it out that from the time of Egypt until the time when they were put into captivity, they never, ever served the Lord. There's a couple of verses, though, I would kind of like to have that we could look at a little bit. The first one is 2 Kings 17, beginning of 13. Richard, do you want to read that for us, please?
Yeah, the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all of his prophets, every seer saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I command your fathers, and which I sent to you by my servant, the prophets. Nevertheless, they would not hear, but stiffened their necks, like the necks of their fathers, who did not believe in the Lord, their God. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant that he had made with their fathers, and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols, because idolaters, and went after the nation who were all around them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them.
Okay, so had God given them enough information for them to not be able to say on the judgment day, we didn't know? You can't condemn us, we didn't know any better. No, he had testified against Israel and against Judah. Now, do we have the same thing today? Did Jesus make some pretty good testimonies to his people and those who think they're his people that are not his people about what's going to happen on the judgment day and how it's going to proceed? Does Jesus testify in Matthew 7:21 that not everybody who calls me Lord, but only those who do the will or do the statutes of my Father in heaven? So it isn't really any different. What happened here is exactly what we're dealing with today. In other words, when Jeroboam took office, God had told him, if you keep my law and my statutes and my ordinances like my servant David did, I will build for you an enduring house. Well, what did he decide to do? Well, he changed the priesthood, he changed the days, he changed the location, he changed many of the things, and thought to himself, as many people do today, that these minor modifications, and of course minor, I guess, is in the eyes of the beholder, but these minor modifications that Jeroboam made, did he think there was a problem? And so the Catholic Church has made some very major modifications in the statutes that God has given to Christians through Jesus. Does God not care about that? Well, of course he does. What the Catholics have done is exactly what Jeroboam did. And what many of the Protestant denominations have done is exactly what Jeroboam did. And so God wants it clearly understood. When I testify to you that you should keep my statutes, and you decide to keep the statutes of the nations instead of my statutes, then what's coming? So God's statute is that if a man lies with a man or a woman lies with a woman, it is what? It's an abomination. What's the statutes of the nations today?
It's okay.
And what are some of the denominations doing? They're trading God's statutes for what? Statutes of the nations. Has God already warned us how this is going to end up?
Yep.
And so, again, it's there, it's clear, there's example after example in the Old Testament to prove it. And yet, what are people wondering today? I mean, this can't be that bad. I mean, look, at the majority are going in this direction. And once again, as it's always been, the people who are standing with God are in the tiny minority. But who's going to win? The people who side with God or the majority? See, and it's tough to see it because, you know, as we live in this world, who do we see the majority being? Who's the ones in power? Who's the ones in control? Who's the ones that we need to be careful? Well, if you're smart, it's God, right? But some people have a hard time with that. All right, let's go ahead and turn to page 3. We'll just spend a few minutes on the, quote, rebirth of Samaria. Now, after Tiglath-Pileser and after the Assyrian kings came through, what's left in Israel? Probably less than a piece of an ear. There's very little left. And so then who are these people that Jesus is talking with? Who's this Samaritan woman? And who are these Samarians or Samaritans? And why do the Jews hate the Samaritans? And well, it's all given here. It's all explained here. So let's see, where do we end up? Michael, you want to read? It's on page 3, 2 Kings 17:24-26.
Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon.
Just do your best.
Katha, Ava, Hamath, and from Sepharim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in the cities. And it was so, at the beginning of their dwelling there, that they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them.
Okay, so this is the beginning of the rebirth of Samaria. Never really changed. These are the people that are there. Do they have any blood of Abraham in them?
No.
Obviously not. Do they have any tie to Israel at all? No, these are Gentiles. These are people from Babylon and Cuthan and Ava and Hamath and from Sepharim. And all these people, they have their own gods. And so they don't show, do they have any respect for God? No, they don't know anything about God. And so, as I point out in the paragraph under, the fear spoken of here appears to be they didn't even acknowledge God's existence. They didn't even acknowledge that he was there. They simply forgot, they sought to forget that he was ever there. So they send a letter to the king of Assyria, and they say, we need you to send us a priest to teach us about the God of this land. Well, who does he send? Look at the very last line there on 2 Kings 17, 26 through 28, verse 28. One of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel. Now, is he the kind of guy that can teach them how to serve God? This is Jeroboam's worship in the city of Bethel. This is a priest from Bethel. He's not going to be able to teach them anything. And then we see what the fear of God meant to them. Let's see. Dodie, how's your tongue with all these weird names? You want to do it? Okay, 2 Kings 17, 29 through 33.
However, every nation continued to make gods of its own and put them in the shrines in the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities where they dwelt. The men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, the men of Cuth made Nergal, the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites made Niphaz and Tartak, and the Severites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anamelech, the gods of Sepharim. So they feared the Lord, and from every class they appointed for themselves priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. They feared the Lord, yet served their own gods, according to the rituals of the nations from among whom they were carried away.
Okay, so does this sound like we got a real good group of people here now? No, these are the people that Jesus is dealing with. These are the people that the Jews did not, they despise them. Can you see why they might despise them? When you look at what they're doing now, clearly over the next 600 years, or 700 years, actually. Clearly, over the next 700 years, there's going to be some blending and softening, but that's where these people... How could children of Abraham have any relationship with these people? And how could godly people... You know, when the woman of Samaria says, we worship God on this mountain, and you say that Jerusalem is the place to worship. Which is the place to worship? I mean, when you see this kind of stuff, what do you think about that question? It's just outrageous. And yet Jesus is very kind. Well, we worship what we know. You worship what you don't know. Is that kind of an understatement? But he does that a lot. Remember he says, the man you're with now is not your husband, and you've had how many husbands? So he's very kind with this woman. But anyway, I just wanted you to see how Samaria came into being and the kind of people that were in there. Yes.
What does it mean when it says they feared the Lord? I mean, they serve their own gods. What kind of fear is this?
Well, it's just like today. I mean, you got the Unitarians who say everybody's going to be saved. There's no such thing as hell. But do they fear the Lord? Do they respect him? Wow. In their own way, right? I mean, in their own way, they do. We're a God-fearing nation, right? In our own way. But it's not as God-fearing as it used to be, and it was never really God-fearing. I mean, there were people who lightly held to the Bible, but they did what they wanted to do, and they served God the way they wanted to serve God. And so, and he concludes it with, that's how it still is to this day, in that next verse. So to this day, they continue practicing the former rituals. Now, we don't know exactly when the book was written, but we know that it closes, and that's what I have as the very last verse on page 3. This is how the book of Kings ends, in the 37th year of the captivity in Babylon. So we're halfway through the Babylonian captivity. Babylonian captivity occurred in, the last wave was 586. It was 606, 596, 586. In 586, Jerusalem was destroyed, and the final group of people were carried into captivity. So from 586, then we got the 70 years. So we're a couple hundred years down the road here, and nothing's changed there. And of course, through the Testaments, nothing would have changed very much. So these are the people that Jesus is dealing with in the time of his life on earth. And so when Philip goes to Samaria and preaches the word to them, he's preaching to, you know, pretty kissing cousin to Gentiles. All right, any other comments or thoughts?
Right. Yeah, and this idea of people being sincere, it's kind of like what you mentioned earlier with Matthew 7:21. We think of the denominations. There are many people in the world today, Catholics or Protestants or whatever, who truly do love the Lord and truly fear the Lord, but they continue to serve their own gods.
Right.
And so they're either, you know, deceiving themselves, they don't study the truth, whatever the reason might be. There's a lot of sincere people that will be lost just because they're in error. You
know? Right. That's true. Carl?
Here you've got they were stiff-necked in this day and age, in this area. And in Stephen, in Acts 7:21, he called them stiff-necked way those many years later.
Right.
They're just like their fathers were.
Yeah. And nothing's really changed today, has it?
Changed.
Very much. Okay, well, next week we're going to go back and we're going to talk about Jehoash, which is, I believe, in chapter 14. Let me see here real quick. Yeah, no, actually, we're going to go back to chapter 12 and spend a little time with Jehoash because he's a very interesting character. And then we'll very quickly get up to Hezekiah, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about Isaiah. So appreciate it. Thank you.